Hello and welcome to the broadcast, our podcast on pensions, investments, insurance and health. This week there are three of us sat around the virtual table to discuss some pensions news. So we've got myself, David Brooks, I'm head of policy here at Broadstone. I've got Simon Kew, our head of market engagement at Broadstone, and we are joined by a very special guest. She was described as a legend in our little chat earlier, but I don't know how it feels.
Just
awkward.
Just old, David, just old.
You can't talk. I've not said your name yet. It's Jade Murray, partner at Adelshaw Goddard. Welcome, Jade. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, David. Good to be
Excellent.
Here.
Excellent. Thank you. You'll hear Simon in a minute, and you're used to Simon's voice anyway. He doesn't need to speak. So we've got a few things on our little list we're going to just talk through for the next 30 minutes or so. We thought we'd start with Virgin Media. And where are we with Section 37 and the sort of Damocles or whatever it is that's hanging over us all? Is it really there? Is it a Schrodinger's problem? I don't know where I am. Do you know, I was trying to look into what's my take on this. And I honestly cannot come down anywhere on what schemes should or should not be doing. It seems very case specific depending on where you are on your journey and what might have happened in the past, and dare I say it, even who your lawyer is. So Jade, where are you currently sitting on the... You're not going to be on the fence, I know that for sure.
Absolutely. Don't believe in sitting on the fence. Hate being on the fence. That's one of the interesting things about Virgin Media. Well, there's a lot of interesting things, actually, about Virgin Media, but the one that's sort of triggered me off into kind of, you know, various rabbit holes. It's a funny thing. There's so many areas of grey in pensions law, but what you normally find is you know all the grey areas, and you do tend to get a consensus amongst pension lawyers around most things, and particularly big things. Mm. So you kind of know where the lawyers are going to line up on things pretty quickly. The first interesting thing about Virgin Media was there was absolutely no consensus on what lawyers thought about what it meant you had to do, you know, as a trustee or sponsor. So you had some saying, you know, you've got that precedent now, you now need to go and do a deep dive and review your historic rule changes and decide whether or not you've got a big problem or not. You had some sitting on the fence and being a bit cagey and saying, well, it all depends and blah, blah, blah. And some saying, probably don't need to, but there might be things that drive you to do it anyway. I think it's nuanced. I'm of the view that generally speaking, trustees are not under a duty because of Virgin Media to go and do a big retrospective exercise. They may well choose to, but I don't believe they're obliged to. And I say that for two main reasons. Firstly, because in effect, there are all kinds of reasons why historic rule changes could be invalid, right? So, you know, you've got things like Section 67, you've got things like amendment power provisos and courage fetters, you've got doctrine of proper purpose, you've got issues around did you comply with the requirements for deeds and company acts. So there's you could come up with a long list of reasons why, if you chose to look at a historic rule change, there could be any number of reasons that could mean it was invalid. There is nothing special about Section 37. So if there's a duty to lift the rug on Section 37, there's a duty to lift the rug on all those other things, in my view. The second point, and it was a point raised by one of the counsel involved in the case at a talk we had on Virgin Media, and it's a point of view I agree with. He drew an analogy with the duties on trustees who are appointed to a trust for the first time. You know, so if you're appointed to trust from day one, you do not have a duty to go and lift the rug, and do a retrospective compliance exercise on everything. You're entitled to assume that, in effect, the trust has been lawfully run until you're put on notice of a specific thing that means you know that it's not. And all right, that's duties for new trustees. But I do think you can draw an analogy. You know, there's cases all the time that throw up new areas of grey. We've had a whole load of stuff around forfeiture, you know, recently. You've had all the GMP stuff. I think you're entitled to assume everything's okay until you know something's not, in terms of your trustee duties. But there are practical reasons that mean it might be sensible, you know, to think about it at least, or do something sooner rather than later. And again, this comes back to things that there's all kind of things I think you will throw into the mix. You know, so if you're near doing a risk transaction, if you're near to a buy-in or a buyout, you would have had to go through this thought process anyway. You know, again, what are you going to look at? How much, how many of those different reasons why rule changes could be invalid are you going to think about, or tell your lawyers to look at when you're doing your benefit specs? You know, some people will look at, would have looked at Section 37 anyway. Some wouldn't. Some would have looked at Section 67. Some wouldn't. You know, people draw those scoping boundaries in lots of different places. So if you're close to that, if that's kind of where your scheme is in its journey, you might do it anyway. If you've done a lot of rule changes, or you've got some reason to think there could be a problem or a smoking gun, you know, you'll probably be conscious of the fact that the longer you leave it to look, the less likely you are to find the pieces of paper you need. You might be thinking about limitation periods if you think, you know, that you might have a claim against an advisor. So there are reasons in the pro camp and reasons in the con camp. And I do think it is genuinely, you kind of start from the position of lots of factors to throw in the mix, but where you end up will be specific to that trustee or that sponsor. So that's kind of where I feel you should be. But actually what's happening is some of the audit firms, and I'm not going to name them because then I'll disappear in the middle of the night courtesy of my firm's risk and compliance team, because we probably have to be more. But, you know, certain of the big audit firms, do you know what I'm just going to say? I think they've lost the plot on Virgin Media. And they've been pushing very aggressively, mainly on the sponsor side, which is the interesting thing, less so actually on the trustee side, but pushing sponsors of DB schemes and basically telling them, in order for us to sign off your audit, you've got to go and lift the rug on Virgin Media. I've heard, as I say, several firms much more aggressively than several others, but of course what the really big ones do tend to, you know, set the tone and set a precedent. I've heard a number of reasons given for that. So one reason I've seen is, oh well, you know, when you look at the audit standards and the audit principles, as auditor we're required to look at legal compliance. You know, so, and again, if there's been a material area of non-compliance that obviously could affect the numbers you're reporting. Well, that's all very interesting. But if this is on the sponsor side, you know, if there's an issue with your rules, if you're calculating benefits incorrectly because of a Virgin Media issue, that doesn't mean the sponsor's non-compliant. Doesn't mean the sponsor's committed a breach of law. The sponsor's legal obligation is to pay the benefits that it has to agree with the trustees need to be paid, you know, under funding rules, under statutory funding regime, you know, until it has a reason to think otherwise, until it's told to think otherwise, you know, it hasn't committed a breach of law just because it might be funding the scheme now and it might turn out to be the case 5 years down the line, you know, that there was a benefit correction. So I'm not particularly persuaded by that argument at all. I've heard another audit firm say, oh, well, you know, because we've got a requirement to state the liabilities. OK, well, yeah, OK, you have the known liabilities at this time. You know, I come back to my mantra, which is there is nothing special about Section 37. So if you're saying there's a duty to lift the rug on Section 37, then there's a duty to lift the rug on Section 67 and proper powers and current, like, and not just wait for the right time for the trustees and the sponsor to do that, depending on what else is going on with them and their scheme. You should just be doing all that now. What? Even for an open scheme that's years and years away from a buyout? It's just crazy. So I do think some of the auditors have lost the plot. The reality is, though, you know, no sponsor really wants an absolute bum fight with their auditor. They've got enough things to have bum fights with their auditor on. It's, you know, already a time-consuming, you know, morale-sapping process. A lot of the time we are seeing sponsors just coming back to trustees and saying, you know, should we at least do a kind of initial review? Should we at least do a gap analysis? You know, should we at least look back for the relevant period and see if we've got, you know, confirmations or at least something in the deeds that suggests we got the certificates? But, you know, again, there are schemes that are saying, no, we're not going to do that now. We're not obliged to do that now. We'll consider the right time to do it. But for various reasons, that's not now. But you just take often that you either got an auditor that's not in the aggressive box, or you've got someone who's prepared to just stand up and have the debate. But it is an interesting one. You know, why do the audit firms get to wake up one morning and say there's been a case? Now we're going to rewrite the rules of sort of fair value accounting. But yeah, again, it's so sorry. I've gone on at length because I feel quite strongly about it. But the short answer is, there is no consensus, and I don't see a sort of a common reaction to it across schemes and sponsors. It's very specific to their circumstances, their timing, what else is going on, their auditor, their sponsor, a whole load of things kind of going into that mix. And that is the right way to approach it, actually, taking into account all the sort of things that impact and come to the right decision for your scheme.
I've heard sort of, people saying that unless you've got a reason to worry, if you've got a scheme, like say maybe, a professional trustee's taken over and they can see that things don't seem to have been done that well. There's a few issues here. The trustees haven't always done things or documented their decisions properly. I'm more nervous that they may not have got the actuarial certification they needed at the time or whatever. And that's, that's one of those nuanced areas that there might be reason to look, because the governance hasn't been great, that those sorts of situations are ones where, but we still get into that position I struggle with is, so what? So you get your deeds, you start looking, you see some deeds that haven't been done right. Okay, so you've now actually discovered a problem. And now what are you going to do? Are you going to go around, very expensive? And, if you think GMP equalization was bad, if you found out, a deed of whatever, changing the accrual rate or something, or retirement age back in, God knows when, was wrong, that's going to be an expensive for the liabilities and administration exercise. Do you really want to bite that and do that, or when there's the possibility that this might go away if the government come along and say, we'll allow some kind of retrospective certification or something?
Yeah, well, and that is, clearly everyone's very, there is a consensus that would be a really good outcome if that's where we ended up. And certainly I have seen some trustees and some sponsors saying, we're not going to lift that rug now. We want to wait and see, because you're exactly right. There's potentially a lot of expense involved with this. And whilst, at the moment, there's not a lot of. Indications that the government will do something. It is kind of still in the very speculative box. There's a lot of lobbying, but there's not a lot of, you're not getting a lot back from government. They've got a lot on their plate, right, with the budget and new government and all the rest of it. So it's not surprising that you're not necessarily suddenly finding this is top of the DWP's to-do list. I suspect it's all around, getting people back to work. But, it's clear that there would be a lot of merit to kind of removing this as an issue. And certainly I have seen some schemes and some sponsors for that exact reason say, we are not going to do a whole load of work and then have a regret risk around that and then find actually it was all unnecessary. Now, how long we can all sit and wait, you can't say that today. You just got to wait and see what, if any, smoke comes out from the DWP and what color it is, and where that goes, probably post budget and once a few other things, regulatory initiatives have been progressed. It's a bit like GMP equalization. It's one of those things that just doesn't put DB pensions, in a good light, or even sometimes, the court decisions. I had one client ask me and say, why is there this issue? Why, what happened to all the pension advisors over the period in question? Why have we even got, missing confirmations? And said, well, the thing that about the case that took everyone by surprise, there were several aspects that everyone went, whoa. But yeah, one aspect was the fact that it was forward looking as well as backward looking, because the test refers to accrued rights. And in pretty much every single other context of pensions law, when you see accrued rights subject to some nuances, it normally means, crudely speaking, past service benefits, you know, not future service benefits. You know, so, you know, for the, you know, a very, what we would say, weighty court of appeal, you know, including the likes of Chris Newdew, who's one of the top pension QCs from Australia, you know, comes out and says, yeah, we can see why, you know, lots of people, you would have thought it was past, you know, backwards looking, but actually, no, it's forward looking, you know, there's, you know, so it's not, you can forgive the pensions industry for thinking, you know, for thinking differently, just like you could forgive the pensions industry and clients for not having tackled GMP equalisation until, you know, you actually got a degree of clarity over what you had to do. You know, it's yet another kind of nail in the coffin, isn't it, sort of, for the reputation of DB, you know, in terms of complexity. I mean, we've got a DC savings crisis, really. And whether or not, you know, well, I think we'll probably have a lot of poor outcomes, which in time, you know, might generate, well, it's already generated discussions about collective DC, query whether it, and there are some commentators out there that say, surely we could, you know, to try and save DB, which on any measure probably does still always give a better outcome for a member than a DC, you know, surely we could look back and have a more simplified form of DB, you know, before all the kind of gold plating changes and the complexity of the last few decades. You know, I think there's a lot of merit in that. That it really would have to be a simple form of DB and not have all this. I mean, some of this is legacy anyway, because it's contracted out. A lot of these issues, GMP, you know, Virgin Media. I mean, the other one, dare I say it, anti-franking. You know, anti-franking is going to be the next big thing that there's going to be a case about. And everyone's going to go back and say, oh, God, because that's horrifically complicated and the legislation is a mess and there's no clarity. And there's all kinds of ways you can go with that stuff. I mean, and again, some are, you know, when I've done buyouts of big schemes and again, you're doing new benefit specs and you look into some of that stuff. That's horrific. Absolutely horrific.
So the latest thing that's been getting me up in a tizzy about is later earnings additions.
Oh, yeah. Joy.
I mean, this is a real page turner for the listener. I love a bit like that. Yeah. But that's just
GMP step ups.
It's just a minefield. Yeah, it's that is an absolute minefield, you know. And there's little agreement, I would say, about how you're meant to do it. It's just
so they're all nails, but they are, you know, these are all kind of legacy things. They're not going to do, you know, sponsors of current DB schemes any good. But what they do indicate is that, you know, complexity is bad. And, you know, someone just needs to sit down. I think like this, you know, whether it's tax, pension, someone just needs to sit down with a blank piece of paper and say, we just wanted to just, you know, come up with something that's a good pension saving vehicle or a decent, you know, fair system, you know, start again with a piece of blank paper and, you know, design something simple. But you'd never end up with where DB pensions ended up. Whether it's possible to bring them back, who knows?
Well, that's something Dave and I have spoken about quite a lot. It's what system do we actually want? What's, because it's all about the member, right? It's making sure that some, well, it should be, exactly. It should be that there is a person that we want to be at a certain standard of retirement income when they come to that point. And the problem with so much around pensions legislation generally is it's just bits that are tacked on. And rather than addressing the root problem, it's all, well, we'll just tack on a bit here and do this and we'll add a bit there and we'll cut a bit off there and that will be fine. And it isn't, because it does create this complexity. I do love where you said there is nothing special about Section 37. And I will say that to the actuaries that we work with when they bring it up next and see their reactions. But legally, that is absolutely right, because there are so many other things. And your point about audit firms getting getting sponsors to sort of lift the drains on this from an audit perspective. I've heard that as well. I'm aware of that being done because it's a revenue generator, and it's not being done for the right reasons, unfortunately. It's exactly. using a very public case and a very public appeal case to generate revenue, and that's the wrong thing because the member doesn't benefit from that, the sponsor doesn't benefit from that, so why should it be happening? It's frustrating when we see that.
Yeah, I mean, I tell you what, Simon, could do a whole other podcast on, what audit firms are doing, you know, with pensions errors and whether it's proportionate or sensible or not. I mean, Virgin Media is just the latest one. I've seen, again, like, you know, sponsors perhaps where it's just DC and it's auto enrollment, but they again, they find out something's gone wrong, you know, the contributions. And so, you know, I have clients that absolutely, you know, gold standard, want to do the right thing, put the members back in the place they should be, just want to let the regulator know what they're doing, you know, sort it all out, calculate, fix it. And the audit firm has gone nuts. You're on calls with like 10 people from the auditor. They're wanting to like micromanage the communications with the regulator. They wanted to almost to do like a legal due diligence report on everything you're doing. You know, look, all professional services firms, lawyers, auditors, actuaries, we've all got conduct regulators, we've all got professional standards, we've all got backsides to cover, okay, I get it, and we've all got compliance departments to keep happy, but the uncommerciality of it, the gravy train nature of it, I'm not surprised employers pull the hair out. You might say it's turning into a bit of an auditor bash, and I'm a lawyer, right? So I shouldn't throw stones in people's houses. But it's a trend I have observed, I would say, in the last two or three years, where again you've got a kind of thing that might have gone wrong or a thing that could cause an issue, but there seems to be a push by auditors to kind of to a degree that I think is not warranted by the standards or the law, pushing you to deal with it in a way that just feels very expensive and very disproportionate and not very commercial and above and beyond what you could understand them doing, you know, to be comfortable they're satisfying their own, you know, obligations and conduct. It's actually not an issue that's confined to DB. You know, I see it in the DC space as well. As I say, it's probably a podcast for another time. Simon, the thing you said, you know, it's supposed to be, this is supposed to be about the members. Mm. I think the problem with pensions is, one of the many problems with pensions is, it's a political thing, right? It's a political beast. And part of the reason why we're in the place we are with DB, but even with DC now, is politicians just cannot stop tinkering. And it's partly because of the tax overlay, you know, and obviously government and treasury are always very, very concerned about tax. Partly because pensions can be used in the kind of ideological, you know, war between right and wrong and tax, you know, savings and... you know, it's a long-term beast and people need to be able to plan knowing what this vehicle is. If they put their money in, you know, they kind of need to know, how's it going to work from a tax system? What are the benefits I'm going to be able to take? You know, what is the nature of the thing? And my, you know, just over my life, working lifetime, 25 years, if you just think about everything we've gone through and all the changes to pensions, never mind the disaster that was the lifetime allowance abolition and the carnage around the sort of legal changes with that, you know, you could, how the hell can you plan as an individual, as a member, whether you've been in DB or DC or DPP, you know, if you started, you know, contributing in your early 20s, how the hell could you plan? The illustrations are mad, you know, it's the tax system, simplification, and now even, you know, the government trying to, or the signals coming out about potentially mandating investment in UK or trying to now use pension schemes again as a political football around the sort of productive, the growth, UK growth agenda. I kind of just sometimes want to scream and say, well, you just leave them alone and like, just like help them instead of like messing with them. You know, I don't know how individuals are expected to really properly, sensibly plan and think about, you know, long-term retirement and long-term pensions against the backdrop of the last few decades. It's insane, really.
Yeah, and here's the problem that, you know, so many of the headlines will just be that, and well, we've seen with the budget and type, you know, speculation is around, you know, things are kind of happening before they've even happened. You know, oh, they're abolishing tax-free cash, or they're reducing tax-free cash, you know, they're going to flip tax relief, or they're not going to flip tax, or they're going to turn off national insurance, you know, all this stuff. So you're getting people reacting to the headlines of what might happen, and it hasn't even happened. And that's, you know, our end, you know, the administrators at the coalface, who are getting members phoning up saying, oh, I want to get my tax-free cash. And, you know, and you say, well, no, you know, A, you're under 55, or B, okay, well, you're not going to get it in time for the budget, I'm afraid, you know, because it takes, what happened that fast? You're in a DB scheme. It doesn't happen like that. You know, it's not a tap we can just suddenly turn on for you. And, you know, it creates a lot of disquiet, because all that stuff always gets around the world a lot faster than the truth of what will actually happen, which might not be anything. Anyway, we aren't going to talk about the budget too much, because this is going to come out after the
budget. That's because I refuse to speculate on what would be in it.
I know. And
I'm speculated out.
I have been party to the speculation. I do regret it. But, you know, like the game, innit? But the other thing we wanted to talk about was, in this sort of DB space, is around getting money back to the sponsor, because that's becoming a conversation. So if you've been involved for 25 years, you probably never thought you'd have. But conversations about actually giving money back to sponsors. It'd be interesting to see what you're seeing out there, Jade, about that.
Yeah, so it's very topical, particularly topical last week with the latest HMRC newsletter, because buried away right at the end of that was a tiny little nugget, authorised surplus payment charge. I'm going to read it out because I think there's quite a few people that haven't necessarily been aware that there's been a debate within pensions industry about how the surplus tax charge is calculated if a company takes a withdrawal of surplus out of the scheme. So the little nugget in the newsletter says, blah, 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 you know, tax charge set out in the Finance Act. This charge arises on the value of the gross amount of the authorised surplus payment and not the amount received by the sponsoring employer on the refund of surplus. HMRC will update its gut PTM and give you a few examples to reflect this. So it's this thing, it's how do you calculate it? Is the tax charge calculated on the gross amount of the payment or the amount that is received by the employer? And there's a subtle difference there. I don't take credit for spotting the issue. It was I can't actually remember who the person was, otherwise I would credit them. But there's someone from one of the consultancies posted something on LinkedIn a while ago, and that's where I first saw it, basically saying, I've actually looked at the wording of the Finance Act and I think everyone's calculating the charge wrong when you actually look at what the wording says. And you know, we all went, oh, that's very interesting. Surely we can't all have been getting it wrong since, you know, 2006 2007. So anyway, there's been a bit, you know, generated a bit of industry chat. We had a client that was interested in that, you know, that's looking at, you know, due to receive return surplus. We went to council on it. And interestingly, a council came back and said, yeah, clear as day, you know, you've all been reading it wrongly. We agree with the, you know, the chap at the council agrees with the chap at the consultancy. We're like, oh, it's very interesting. Clearly, yeah, so obviously there's been a bit of chat. Clearly that has got back to HMRC, because I think that little nugget in the HMRC newsletter is HMRC's riposte, you know, coming back and saying, no, you know, there isn't a nuance, there isn't an alternative. You know, it's as you always thought it was. I'd be surprised if we were the only firm, you know, that had perhaps maybe gone to council on it. As I say, there is an awful lot of activity around surplus. You know, David, as you said at the start, you know, there will be a lot of clients looking at it. So this is not the only issue. You know, we've had doing well across the place. old school negotiations between trustees and sponsor and debates around, you know, trustee duties. Is there a duty to negotiate? Must I have a quid pro quo? Well, Bristol, as far as the Ombudsman's concerned, Bristol Water makes clear you don't. You know, the argument that if the company bears the risk, it should get the reward, you know, has been upheld, I think rightly. And I think the court would say the same if it, you know, Bristol Water had gone to the court rather than the Ombudsman. You know, you've got all the sort of well-trodden principles that apply to trustee decision making, you know, which are all very long-standing and all completely useless for actually telling trustees, you know, how to approach it, because actually they have a lot of latitude. You know, if you've got a trustee discretion, if you're always in prescriptive and just tells you what to do with it, you know, so there's kind of quite a lot of latitude there for trustees to bluntly pay it all to the company, pay it all to members, do it 50-50, do it 2/3, 1/3. But then there's an awful lot of things you can throw into the mix. But so, you know, where you end up landing with that, you know, again, can be quite influenced just by literally like kind of the specifics of the individuals on the trustee board or the professional trustee firms involved, sort of history of the scheme, history of maybe discretionary increases or not. You know, so there's kind of well-trodden relevant factors that everyone always kind of cites in their advice. But my experience is a lot of the time it comes back to sort of how emotionally where almost are the trustees feeling in terms of fairness and sort of morality. And, you know, I think trustees generally tend to be less comfortable paying it all one way or the other, you know, or to company or to members. They like to do a bit for both. And I think that does tend to be where, you know, a lot come out. But I have, you know, I've seen a number of examples of it all going back to the company. You know, once all the as of right benefits have been secured, personally don't think there's anything wrong with that. But yeah, very, very interesting, you know, discussions and debates. And again, I mean, it's a bit of a cliched mantra from pension lawyers, but it is very, very scheme, you know, specific. But yeah, I mean, as I say, as someone who's been a lawyer for 25 years, so I qualified. I started in 98 when we still had some surpluses. And, you know, you even had a tax regime that meant if you had a surplus above a certain level, you positively had to take steps to reduce it. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we all went into the world of deficits and nobody did very much on surplus. And now we've kind of all come back again, you know, and we're back to surplus. And you've got the whole debate about runoff, you know, as a long term runoff as a strategy. Which is, again, is a whole other, you know, interesting debate and you know, very different views around trustees and sponsors. But yeah, suddenly, pensions is just cyclical, right? If you're kind of in the industry long enough, everything kind of, you know, comes back or comes back round.
Flares. Yeah. I remember there was one sponsor when I joined the regulator in 2007 that had $500 million surplus. So they wanted to stop contributions. By the time I left the regulator in 2010, they had $500 million deficit. So you're right. I mean, it is cyclical, right? And the decision making process from trustees, you would expect, or I would expect, it would be perhaps different if it's a sort of sole corporate trustee to if you have a high pensioner or member representation on a trustee board. There's likely to be more. It was certainly a louder voice from the members to get some of that surplus back than if it's perhaps a sole corporate trustee that's possibly taking the view that you said there, that the employer takes the reward, or they takes a risk, so therefore they should get the reward. But yeah,
it's interesting because should it, if you actually think about policy, you know, and the kind of the runoff thing does link to thoughts about what surplus policy should be. We obviously had the government consultation just before the general election, and we've obviously had the reduction in the tax rate. So there's been a bit of government focus on surplus. I think, you know, under as a response to, you know, kind of industry and UK PLC pressure to, you know, look at realising greater proportion of surplus for the benefit of sponsors. You know, should it actually depend? Should it really literally depend on, have you got a corporate, you know, if you think about, you've got the vagaries of surplus rules and wind-up rules, you've got the vagaries of different trustee structures, you know, those are big significant variables in what does end up with surplus before you get into the tax overlay. You know, is it a sensible system? You know, discuss, you know, there is, trusts are amazingly flexible things. And their strength is that they do allow you to take into account the specific, you know, specifics of your circumstances in a huge wide array of situations. You know, and trustees do have a lot of latitude where they've got discretion. So it does allow, it's a very, very flexible thing. But equally, it does mean often there can be very little consistency on some of these big things where lots of money is involved and at stake. And sometimes, again, you do think, and we've kind of come full circle back to Virgin Media, but there is a case for, I think, a greater degree of consistency around some of the areas of decision making, you know, where lots of money is involved or lots of risk, you know, value at risk is involved. Again, if you were starting with a blank piece of paper, would you set a series of surplus rules that literally turn on the vagaries of rules which may have been drafted decades ago, may have gone through several iterations because of the changing, you know, overriding law, and then you end up with something that everyone has to go to court to try and ascertain what is the proper purpose of that rule. Again, great for flexibility, a disaster for any degree of certainty or, you know, clear signposting of the right decision. I don't know, discuss. It's great for us. Uncertainty is always great for us and for lawyers. Is it sensible for deciding how to carve up $100 million surplus or $200 million? I don't know. I'm not sure it is. But
well, I think that's probably one for our listeners to have a view on, and maybe they'll write in and comment on LinkedIn or goodness knows what else. But as you say, Jade, we've come full circle pretty much back to where we started on Virgin Media. So probably a good time to draw this to a close. It's been an absolutely fascinating discussion. Thank you so much. So just for our listeners, a reminder, Jade Murray, partner at Addleshaw Goddard, thank you so much for your time today.
You're very welcome, Simon. It's been really good to chat. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Jade. Thank you to my colleague, David Brooks. And we look forward to you tuning in to our very next broadcast. Thank you so much.